Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, have you heard about Ignite Seattle? It's a volunteer-powered event that started back in 2006. The concept is simple. People, most of them not public speakers, go on stage in front of 700 or so other people to share part of their life for 5 minutes. That could sound like your basic nightmare, but be brave, it pays off. The talks are often funny, or informative, or inspiring, and sometimes they just floor you. We're presenting talks from Ignite Seattle 32 here. It took place on February 23rd at Town Hall Seattle. Their next event is coming up on May 18th, again at Town Hall. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full event and links to videos of all of the talks on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. Here, MC Scott Birkin launches the program.
Good evening. Welcome to Ignite Seattle 32. Welcome. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to see you all. How are you doing? That is a fantastic answer. So my job, I'm Scott Birkin, I'm your MC for the night. Talks are open submission, so we don't do a lot of pre-curation. We wait for the talks to come in and we try to figure out how can we assemble a great evening out of this. And there's one theme that came up tonight, which is sort of coincidental, serendipitous, which we like, which has to do with our bodies. So our first talk, and as you will learn, we are very open-minded about the way we talk about things here. So you're going to hear a fantastic opening talk. Sarah Gensler is going to talk, the title of her talk is Let's Talk About Menstruation. Please round of applause for Sarah to come up on stage.
Hi, everyone. Please raise your hand if you or anyone you love has ever shed their uterine lining. Look around you. Great. Okay, I'm here to talk to you about why talking about menstruation started having me make good connections with unlikely people. And that started with a menstrual cup. A menstrual cup is a silicone vessel that you put into your vagina, it collects your menstrual fluid, and then you dump it out and you reuse it as an alternative to tampons or pads. It gets you real up close and personal with all of the bloody glory of your body. And my friend was adamant that I try to use one. And the way she convinced me was by telling me it is environmentally friendly to use a menstrual cup and also is cost effective, and I am deep in student debt. So I went for it. And it was disgusting. I was totally repulsed. And I couldn't even use it for the first few months because I would try and it would freak me out and then I'd put it away and then I would shun it and then I'd get it out again and start the whole cycle over again. And after a couple months of that, I took a step back and I started to question why that was happening. What's going on in my subconscious that was motivating this visceral reaction to my own biology? Because I can actually objectively look at a period as something cool and something beautiful, and I'm not afraid of blood, so what's my excuse? And if you are having those same kind of questions right now and feel uncomfortable with how I'm talking about this, think about how many people around you are raising their hands earlier and maybe start asking yourself those same questions. When I was processing those questions, I started writing about it. And I wrote a personal narrative detailing exactly what I just talked about with my menstrual cup, but also exploring those deeper questions of what's going on here. And I came to these conclusions, these sort of speculative conclusions about ingrained sexism and ideas like that that are kind of penetrating my subconscious and motivating these feelings. And I decided I needed to share that on a wider platform because I felt like if I didn't, I would be directly contradicting the whole idea, which is why can't we talk about this? Let's please talk about menstruation. And it was really scary sharing that story on social media because I used really raw language like digitally penetrate myself and a confession about using two tampons at a time in high school. And in addition to that, this is 2 or 3 weeks after the presidential election, and everything that I would plug into social media felt just incredibly politically charged. And within that political conversation, everything felt deeply, deeply polarized to such an extent that there were these two camps, and it was me voting for one candidate and everyone who did with me, and then this other camp where people voted for another candidate. And no matter what we posted, no matter how topical it was, it felt incredibly, deeply political. So posting this felt really anxiety provoking. I was totally overcome by this really shaky feeling of what's going to happen? Are they going to, these people in this other camp, are they going to judge my raw encounter, my raw conclusions I came to? But then to my surprise, over the next few hours, a lot of positive feedback started rolling in. And it wasn't just from my close friends and family. It was from people from all levels of connectedness throughout my life who I hadn't talked to in years. Actually, my favorite comment came from someone who I would firmly place in the them category as far as political action on Facebook. I mean, they vocally supported the candidate I didn't vote for. And they wrote something on my wall saying, wow, I'm surprised. I didn't think I would like this, but I did. That's kind of the point, right? And it wasn't the point, but then it became the point because I realized that I had permission to start talking about this with more people. And I brought it up at networking events with people I hadn't even talked to before. And it went great, surprisingly. And I started a conversation with my dad about feminism and what that means to me, and it was wonderful. And then I started realizing that there was a bigger lesson here, and that's that there is a common human experience, that there's this wealth of human commonalities, that if we can tap it and we can really dig in there, that we can make connections with people that we never thought we could connect with. There's this human factor that I think if we acknowledge it and we don't let it fail to be a factor, we have power there. And I challenge you and I challenge myself to go into every interaction with that assumption that you have a connection with whoever you're talking to. But an even bigger challenge that I know that we can all handle is to actively seek out and reveal these human commonalities, this human factor, because I think it's becoming more and more important as we go forward in this political and social landscape together. And if you want to talk to me about anything, come up and talk to me afterward, of even periods or menstrual cups, because I'm sort of an expert on those now. And if you want to read my original story for any sort of inspiration as to how we can tap into these ideas and what people are receptive to, feel free to go to my Medium page and check it out. Thank you.
So following along one little stream you'll experience tonight about human biology and commonality, something else we all share is an intestinal system. So our next talk, Hannah Thomasy is going to talk about a gut feeling, the microbiome, and our health. Please welcome Hannah to the stage.
Okay. We usually think that our health is governed by our own choices and our own genetics. But today I'm going to be talking about how trillions of tiny organisms living inside of us actually play a huge role in our physical and even mental health. The microbiome is the genetic material of all of the organisms that live on and in us. It's mostly made of bacteria, but also includes viruses, archaea, and fungi. Just like the Earth has a lot of different environments where different plants and animals live, our body has a lot of environments where different types of microbes live. Microbes have colonized the entire surface of our skin, even the surface of our eyes. They live in our nose and mouth, our throat and lungs, and throughout our entire digestive tract. Even though microbes are probably important in all of the human systems in which they're found, the one I'm going to be talking about today is the gut microbiome, simply because that's the one we know the most about. We have trillions, if not hundreds of trillions of microbes and thousands of different species. This is the equivalent of carrying around a small dog with us all the time. We have about 2 to 6 pounds. We usually think that microbes are gross and disease-causing, and sometimes they are. But our gut microbes are really important in helping us be healthy. Gut microbes help us to digest our food. They produce vitamin B and vitamin K. And especially in infancy, they're really important for helping our immune system develop properly. In fact, notobiotic or microbe-free mice are actually much less healthy than mice that were raised with a normal complement of microbes. The problem is, we don't really know what a healthy microbiome should look like, even though we know that having a healthy microbiome is important for being a healthy person. This is a chart where different colors represent different species of microbes from the guts of people living in different places in the world. Even though these are all from healthy people, we can see that the composition of their gut microbiome actually varies quite a lot. And so a healthy microbiome is probably different for everyone. So we do know that a healthy microbiome is diverse and balanced, But sometimes, potentially harmful species can take over, producing an imbalance or dysbiosis. There are a lot of disorders associated with dysbiosis, including gut disorders like irritable bowel, but also psychiatric disorders like depression and neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's. So if we know that an imbalance of microbes can predispose us to certain diseases, can we manipulate our microbes to treat disease? And it's possible. I think we're getting there. The problem is, like I said, we have thousands of different microbes, and we don't really know what they all do. Probably the more we learn about the role of each species of microbes, the more we'll be able to manipulate them to treat or prevent disease. So, you've probably heard that probiotics are good for you, like these women really enjoying their yogurt. And the good news is that some cases, probiotics actually are really helpful. There's good evidence that they're helpful in treating gut disorders like irritable bowel and ulcerative colitis. And although the study of probiotics and mental health is still in its infancy, there's at least one study showing that probiotics can be helpful in treating depression. The problem is, not all probiotics are created equal. And in fact, how a probiotic is classified is really important. If a probiotic is classified as a drug, it comes under strict FDA regulation and has to be proven safe and effective before it can be sold to you. But if it's a dietary supplement, it just has to be generally accepted as safe and doesn't have to be proven effective at all. So be careful what you're spending your money on. So probably the absolute coolest part of manipulating the microbiome is the story of fecal transplants and C. diff. C. diff is a potentially fatal bacterial infection that actually kills about 15,000 people a year in the United States alone. It's highly resistant to antibiotics. But the super cool thing is that if fecal bacteria is transplanted from a healthy donor into someone with C. diff, it cures them about 90% of the time in cases where antibiotics have already failed. So that's a pretty miraculous life-saving treatment for a lot of people. All right, so if you like learning about the human body and how we're all really gross and have weird diseases, check out my podcast. It's called The Hypochondriac's Guide, and it's available on iTunes. Thanks for coming.
Great job. It's good. Among the things in the Maslow hierarchy of needs, which, by the way, is kind of a made-up hierarchy. Maslow admitted it. He's like, I'm making this up. It sounds good, and now we believe it's like gospel. Hierarchy needs is that funny meme where people slash through everything and the everything is just Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi is the only thing you really need anymore. So in Seattle, that might be true, given how much we obsess about our bandwidth and such. So the next talk is going to help you out with that. Patrick McKenna is going to talk about how to become a Wi-Fi ninja. Please welcome him to the stage.
Holy cow, you guys are awesome. You want to do something awesome? Let's do something awesome. Let's imagine that you've invited all of your friends and neighbors over to do movie night on Friday. And you put up your projector, you've gotten the Apple TV out, you've hooked everything up. It's about an hour before everyone shows up and you get an error message. But this is cool. Everybody knows what we do. What do? We reboot the Apple TV. Doesn't work. Well, there's a super power that we all have. We know that if we go to our wireless router and we hit the reboot button, that's going to solve all of our problems. But then we fire up our Apple TV again and we've got the same error message. What if we use one of our computers? Everything seems to be working there, but not on the Apple TV. Maybe we overestimated our technical ability. And people are showing up in about a half hour and you're realizing that you've made a pretty bad life choice. You don't really like people, you're more of an introvert. And so, what are we gonna do? There's a lot of people who are gonna show up and be disappointed. Wouldn't it be great if it was easy to troubleshoot your own Wi-Fi? It's super easy, it's actually something that all of you can do. There are three concepts that you need to have a handle on, and I'm gonna share those with you tonight. So those three concepts that you need to understand are your wireless connection, something called internet protocol, it's IP, and then something called domain name services. We say DNS. So we say it all together. Connection, IP, DNS. Connection, IP, DNS. Connection, IP, DNS. Connection, IP, DNS. Okay, you got it. What is the connection? That's your wireless strength. You want to be on a strong wireless network, and you want to be on your wireless network. If you're on a weak network, things are going to go bad, and if you're on the wrong network, things are going to go bad. So make sure you're on the right connection. Internet protocol is this thing that does routing on the internet. If you're going to send mail to someone, you need to know their street address, and you also need to send your destination, the sender address. Computers work the same way. If you're going to send traffic on the internet, they have something called an IP address, and it looks like this crazy fun number here. You also need to validate that you can send traffic to connect IP addresses on the internet. You also need to validate that you can send traffic to IP addresses on your home network. So you want to check IP. Does my computer have an IP address? Can I send traffic to the IPs that are in my home network? And can I send traffic to the internet? The cheat here is we just try to send traffic to the internet first. And there's this magic spell, ping 8.8.8.8. That address, I think you can all remember. You see traffic going there and you get a response, you know you have connections to the internet. Nothing, then you know something's wrong at home and you need to try to test your connections there. The third component is this cool thing called domain name services. Computers really like numbers and they hate names. And people really like names and hate numbers. And so DNS bridges the gap. It's the thing that takes our google.com or our facebook.com and turns us into one of those cool IP addresses there. If the computer can't access a DNS server, it doesn't know how to do translations. So you would actually be accessing the internet, but then you get these funky error messages that tell you that Google couldn't resolve, do you want to Google for Google? So DNS is this third component. Every computer is configured to point to a DNS server. And so the way that you can test DNS is this magic spell, NS lookup. And you can pick any domain you like, google.com, facebook.com, whatever. You get IP addresses coming back, you know DNS is working okay. You get nothing, something's wrong with your DNS server. So in our case before, I had my Apple TV pointing at the wrong DNS server. So DNS lookups failed, and then I got that weird iTunes message, even though I was actually connected to the internet. So that's really the secret here. It's those three simple things: your wireless connection, internet protocol, and domain name services. Your goal is to figure out, is my home network working, yes or no? And then the second part is, can I access stuff on the internet, yes or no? That's it, three things. I think you all can do this. I hope you thought this was cool. My name is Patrick McKenna. By day, I work for a company called AT&T, and I'm responsible for security in the mobile network. I work on a team that keeps 130 million subscribers safe from hackers. By night, I'm working on a book that teaches kids who are heading off to college about cybersecurity. If you think that's cool, please follow me on Twitter. I'll be announcing as the publication date gets closer. I hope you enjoy the rest of the evening. Thanks very much, everybody.
Great job. As frustrating as things like bad cell service, your Wi-Fi going down can be, it's easy for us, given all the things we have in our lives, all the privileges we have, to lose perspective on what's important. And I think our next talk is going to help reset our perspectives in a bunch of ways. Corinne Johansson is going to talk about Badass 3.0, and I'll let her explain to you what that means. Please welcome her to the stage.
What's the first rule of Fight Club? Tonight, I'm talking about a different Fight Club with a different rule. I run a Fight Club for people with Parkinson's, and our first rule is to kick Parkinson's ass. My fighters show up every morning to just say no to I can't. And they know that Ali could float like a butterfly and sting like a bee because he had practiced the balance and agility to be able to dance around the ring. So that's how we train, with boxing, some martial arts, even a few fundamentals from parkour. So I work with a gym full of people I consider badasses. Tonight, you'll meet three of them. Badass number one is Fred. Fred has had cerebral palsy his entire life, and then Parkinson's stepped into the fray. Cerebral palsy affects his left side, and Parkinson's his right. But boxing balanced things out for him. He became stronger on the left side and more flexible on the right. Beyond that, by training like a pro fighter, jumping rope, he went from 2 consecutive jumps to 22 in just a few months. How's that for results? Badass number two, Jeff, has hated and avoided exercise and the gym his entire life. But, and I bet a few of you can relate to that. But when Parkinson's came along and his meds only took him to 90% of what he deemed acceptable, he took up the sweet science. And he discovered that he had life-changing benefits from the program. So he decided a few weeks ago to go to training camp so that he could become my assistant coach and help others. Badass number three, Big Mike, is what many of you might consider a typical badass. He was a football player, beach volleyball player, completed the 2-day 200-mile STP cycling event at 39, took up pumping iron at 55. So as you can imagine, when I'm holding mitts for Mike's hooks and uppercuts, he can practically take my arm off. But other times, he freezes. And this is one of the symptoms of Parkinson's that when I went to the World Parkinson's Congress, I expected that the top names in neurology would have the magic answer for Mike and for me as his trainer. But they're still doing research about the whys. What I've been able to do since then, however, is to put together a toolbox of ways to either avoid or recover from those episodes. And so just the other day, we were working on a new routine, and Mike was hitting even harder than usual and not freezing. So I started this fight club because my dad had been hit hard by Parkinson's. But my fighters have reminded me that no matter what obstacle we're facing, we can hit back. So anyone who wants to learn more about what we do can hit me up after the presentation, or you can find us online at BeatPDWA. Thank you.
Great job.
So our next talk, Virginia Emery is going to talk about how being uncomfortable is really the only way to grow. Please welcome Virginia to the stage.
Hi, I'm Virginia, and my life's mission is to feed the planet. My superpower is being uncomfortable. So, here, great start, talking in front of a room full of people. Let's talk about uncomfortable. Uncomfortable is defined as causing or feeling slight pain, a little bit of discomfort, some unease, awkwardness. These are not pleasant things. We spend most of our lives running away from uncomfortable, pursuing comfort. And so I'm hoping today to convince you to turn the other way and embrace uncomfortable. To start us off, think back to your most uncomfortable time. Being a teenager, you all remember the awkwardness of growth spurts and the horrors of high school. But those are all important parts of your development into an adult and the person you are today. Remember back to that awkward feeling when you're asking someone out for the first time. That uncomfortable feeling is an important step to finding true love. Think about the last run you went on. Any runners in the room? Have you ever had to fart when you're running? Usually there's a really cute person behind you, and if you aren't willing to deal with that uncomfortable feeling, you'll never get stronger or faster. So really, being uncomfortable is important for personal growth, spiritual, emotional, and physical. So my journey with uncomfortable, it started with one of my first jobs, tree planting. And tree planting sucks. You are dropped off in the middle of nowhere by your dad. You get every day driven out at 7 a.m. to a clear cut, a totally desolate place. You're plopped there with a couple thousand trees, and for 12 hours, you walk this plot of clear cut planting trees. To top it all off, the rhythm with which you plant is perfectly timed to Sir Mix-a-Lot. And I had that stuck in my head for 2 months. Along with that, there was this constant battle against the millions and millions of mosquitoes. So many mosquitoes that you can't keep your mouth open. You end up eating them. But I embraced the Zen philosophy of the Navy SEAL, which is learning to be comfortable with uncomfortable. And that's brought me to incredible places. I can be in the most beautiful jungle, and despite the bugs, really appreciate it. I can pursue my greatest fear of drowning, and go whitewater rafting, and have incredible adventures down the Grand Canyon. And most recently, my willingness to be uncomfortable has allowed me to start my own company. So a whole other story, I farm bugs to help farmers grow more food. But this journey of being a business owner has a lot of uncomfortable times. Probably the most significant has been having to fire people. This is a really uncomfortable feeling, and it's because there's so much pain and stress and uncertainty on the other side of that equation. Which brings me to what uncomfortable is not. If you are in pain, or you're sad, or you're angry, those feelings overwhelm you, and you can't make decisions properly. Uncomfortable, it's something different. It's unique. It's this knife's edge, this temporary feeling, moving from one comfort to another, a position of great privilege, and it gives you a lot of perspective. Our country, of course, has been feeling very uncomfortable, as has Seattle, and I think we all have the challenge now of harnessing and moving towards uncomfortable, to have the hard conversations. The problem is if we don't do this, things that would make us feel uncomfortable become desensitized as we try to make them comfortable. We go through this routine of making something visceral into something normal. This week, the UN declared the first famine since 2011. This should make everyone super uncomfortable. And this picture, I know it's making everyone here uncomfortable, and that's a good thing. Because uncomfortable is the sign that something needs to change, and that change is happening. And at least for me, uncomfortable is what lets me be the change that I want to see in the world.
Thank you.
The next talk, Bridget Foley is going to talk about the power of wearing your pain on your sleeve. Please welcome her to the stage.
So there are two ways to live a life free of grief. The first is to never love anything. No person, no pet, no television show, nothing. The second is to go ahead and love things, but to die before everything you care about. Those are your choices. So just for the sake of time, I'm going to assume you know they both suck. My point is that if you are very lucky, if you live a statistically normal amount of years and you have love in your life, you are going to experience grief. It is absolutely universal. Everyone in this room and this city and this planet is going to be in mourning at some point in their lives. So while that's sad, it also means that it's normal. It's expected. My question is, if grief is normal, why are we bad at it? Because we are bad at it. And I don't mean taking care of people who are grieving. I mean being people who are grieving. Now, I'm going to tell you something, and it might make some of you uncomfortable, but I promise it has a purpose. 3 years ago, my daughter died. It is the kind of loss that people say is unimaginable. But what they mean is that it's too painful to even think about, much less experience. There is a part of me that will never leave the room where my daughter died, and that is the truest thing that I can say. Okay, now, how are you feeling? No one's running for the door. You survived. I bet a fair few of you knew exactly what I was talking about when I said I will never leave that room, because you have your own rooms you will never leave. If there is one word that people use to describe the grieving process, it is lonely. And that is the paradox. Grief is universal. Grief is isolating. I am alone. I am in company. We are bad at grief because how to live with it long term is never modeled for us. Grieving people hide it because it's rude to make you feel like I just made you feel. But because other people hide their grief from us, when we experience it ourselves, we feel alone. This leads many of us to believe that loss is something you get over instead of something you get used to. But I have a proposal. I call it the wet chair, wet pants method of grief sharing. Don't worry, the pants and the chair are metaphorical. Let's say you're out for a walk and your favorite little old lady neighbor spots you and she invites you to come sit with her on her porch. But when you get up there, you see that the chair that she's offered you is wet. And you know if you ask her for something to wipe it down, she's gonna have to get up and she's creaky and her dog is in her lap. So do you just sit in the chair? Or do you make your neighbor just a little bit uncomfortable to spare yourself a greater discomfort? A wet chair is a choice a grieving person encounters when they have to decide whether or not to say something that reminds others that death happens, or to live with the wet pants of saying nothing. It's Happy Gilmore was my late wife's favorite movie too. Or actually, I have three children. Now, I don't recommend doing this all the time. Sometimes it is better to have metaphorical wet pants. Job interviews. Public speaking events. But if you can get comfortable with making others just a little bit uncomfortable, you open yourself up to so much more. Because the very worst thing that can happen is that you can remind someone that grief is normal and survivable. And the best thing that can happen, and it can only happen if you are open, is that the person you share with will get a look in their eyes and they will say, "Me too." And that is how you open a door that connects the room that you will never leave to the room that they will never leave. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good stuff. This talk We have so much in our society, in American culture, about people who succeed, and we lionize them and romanticize them. We often use words like genius and prodigy, and we call people that there's some luck, that there's some magical thing that happened that distanced them, their talents from ordinary people. And our next talk is gonna dispel some of those myths and rumors. Stephanie Lukash is gonna talk about how to win a national award. Please welcome her to the stage.
So I won a national award last summer for my work at King County, and it was incredible. It's the sort of thing you aspire to for your entire career, and you think, wow, that would be amazing if that ever happened. I'm a change agent. I change culture in organizations, and I work for King County government. And the reason why I care so much about the work is because of all of you, because you're all taxpayers, and I want my job to be good because I know that it will save you money and time when you do business with us. So I'm a public servant and I'm very proud of that work I do. But I realized in that it was about finding your power and finding the advice I would give to my 22-year-old self if I was to go back in time. And it's not luck. It's about finding your passion and diving in. I've been surprised by the number of people who've said, oh, you're so lucky to have that job, or you're so lucky to win that award or to work part-time. And I tell them all the time, it's not luck at all. It's years of hard work and perseverance and determination. And I'm the person who says yes to challenging assignments. If there's a controversial project that on the team no one wants to take, I say yes. And you know why? Because it stretches me. And I think that's really important. One of my mantras is make yourself indispensable. And that's a piece of advice I give to everyone I mentor. Make yourself indispensable. Think about what you can do to learn, grow, always be stretching, always be learning. And I think that will take you a long way toward finding your own personal power. And for me, my experience has never been that opportunity knocks. I've always knocked for opportunity. And it's really important to know that. If you're gonna find your power, you need to get that straight. You have to knock for opportunity and persist. Don't take no for an answer. If there's a place that you want to work, go for it. Continue, persevere, ask. Don't take no for an answer. It's really important. In my career, I've done this a number of times, and my most recent job change 2 years ago, I left a job I loved. I had a team that was like family, we were all really close, and I took an opportunity that was 2 years with no guarantees, and I had to prove myself, and you know what? I took it and have never looked back. And I think for me, one of the big things in my life, and I think many of us need to learn this, is how to shine. Step into the light. Learn how to be who you really are, and don't let anyone hold you back. And I think a big part of it, too, is learning how to accept credit. When someone says, hey, great job, what you say is simply, thank you. What you don't say is, oh, it was nothing, or oh, it was a team effort, when it really wasn't. If you've done really important work, take credit. It's absolutely important. And you have to apply for the award. It's not like the National Association of Counties said, oh, I think Stephanie Lukash up in King County is doing really great work. Let's give her an award. No, I had to tell our story. I had to work really hard in the application. And it's uncomfortable. It's like when we interview for jobs, and some of us find that uncomfortable, like tooting your own horn and talking about how great you are. But it's important to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Because if you don't, you're not going to find your power. And I guarantee you'll have critics. Guaranteed. And what you have to do is realize, I'm going to keep my power. I'm not going to let my critics take my power from me. And just accept that they're there. It's a challenge, but you can deal with it. And it's really important to do that. And I think for me, one of the big things in my life I think I've done really well is always be in a place of gratitude. Be appreciative of the people around me, the love I have in my life, the good things, especially when things are going difficult or challenging. If you're in a place of gratitude, it takes you a really long way. And I also really think it's important to have a strong work-life balance. I work part-time, like I mentioned, and that's not a small thing. It's a very conscious decision, and it took years of working full-time to get to this place, but I think life is short. And it's really important to take advantage of opportunities and to live fully and to live right now. And one of my big mantras in life is not have regrets, no regrets. So it's really important to remember that life is short. And I think something else that people often don't do, but I think is really important, is to thank the people who helped you along the way. When I found out about the National Award, when the National Association of Counties contacted me, I told my boss. and then I told my husband and my best friend, and then I made two phone calls to two of my mentors who are both retired now, who are critical in my development and who helped me along the way, because I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm on their shoulders and the next generation's on my shoulders, and that's why it's important to mentor those who are coming after us. And finally, I would say, stay humble, but stay hungry. I want all of you to be 90 years old and learning something new, right? Learning how to play chess for the first time, right? Learning some new hobby. Because if you're always hungry, that's how you find your power. You find your passion, you keep working toward it, you're always curious. And who knows, maybe you'll receive a national award too. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, that was excellent. We all have family. We all get mad at people. Some people do it in a healthier way than others. This talk is going to help all of you parents out there think about the emotional context of how you deal with your children. Jenna Pertuset is going to talk about how to be mad at your kids. Please welcome her to the stage.
You got it right?
You did.
Okay.
We all get mad. There is nothing wrong with you if you get mad, although sometimes it can feel like it, especially if you've experienced anger expressed at you in ways that have been abusive or otherwise harmful. It can feel like a load of crap to carry or to impose on other people. And from your personal experience, but also from the ways we're culturally conditioned, if you think about the ways that women's anger, for example, is policed, and the stereotypes like the angry black woman or the good girl, these things are ways of trying to control anger because it feels threatening. Anger is powerful. Anger is necessary. It can be a source of justice and of holding boundaries. We need anger, and we need to model it for our kids in ways that don't harm them and that give them a sense of how to handle their own anger. Our kids aren't lab rats. They don't need immediate and consistent input. So if you're really heated, one constructive thing you can do is nothing. Contain yourself. Hold on to it. Wait until you can handle it better. If you do have control of your emotions, you know, you're angry, but you can be a little creative. You can be playful. You can bring in humor. Then you have the opportunity to change the situation, either in the moment or because you've planned ahead. You know, if you think about the things that you've told your kids 1,000 times, if you think about what always pisses you off, if you can predict it, you can plan for it. And one thing that you want to do to change the situation, essentially, is just get out of it. Not necessarily leave the space you're in, but get out of the conflict as quickly as you can by owning your responsibility for it. What can I do to make this better? Not, how can I make you stop pissing me off? So if we are looking for other constructive ways of handling our anger, we can complain about it, not by biting our kids' heads off, but by finding those places that we can vent and we can move our bodies through our experiences of anger in the ways that we're already moved to. Maybe we need to scream. Maybe we need to punch a punching bag. We find the ways that we can complain or vent anger that are constructive and not hurtful for our kids. One way may be by finding the people who can hear you, the friends who can hear you say, I hate my kid. And they're not going to judge you. They're not going to try to fix you. They're just going to witness you. Now, they'll have compassion for you, but they're not going to collude with you. They're not going to agree, yeah, you're right, your kid is an asshole. When you find those people, when you find the people who can hold those emotions with you, who can help you find your softer emotions, those people are gifts in your life. Those are the people who can help you reach that ultimate constructive expression of anger, which is moving through it into sadness. That sadness, when we can cry about what disappoints us, when we can feel the ways that our expectations haven't been met, when we look at our own failings or the ways that we wish our kids were different, then we have the possibility of being changed by the things we can't change. And that's the ultimate transformation that moving through anger into sadness allows for us. So if you want to constructively handle anger, you can contain yourself, you can change the situation, you can complain about it, or you can cry. So those are all ways that we become the parents who can handle anger in ways that are useful and constructive. So my work is, as a parent coach, I rely on the work of Dr. Gordon Neufeld, who is focused on helping parents understand their kids. My work is helping parents understand ourselves so we can better serve our kids. If you want the notes from this talk and other resources about handling anger, especially for parents, you can text MAD to 444-999. My name is Jenna Pertuset. It looks like Jenny. It sounds like Jenna. And I'm also a mom. And I came to this work because I needed to help my daughter handle her anger, and to do that, I had to handle my own. Thank you.
So coming up next, we love to have a diverse group of people, diverse ideas come up on stage. Coming up next is our youngest speaker tonight, so I want you to give an especially enthusiastic welcome. River O'Connor is going to talk about simulating the international community. Please welcome him to the stage.
When I was in middle school, I got in trouble for writing out the Nazi hierarchy on a whiteboard. I was explaining the plot of The Man in the High Castle to a friend, all right? I love history and politics, and through those passions, I found the Model United Nations Organization. This is a lot. MUN focuses on the General Assembly, the Security Council, the Secretariat, the Economic and Social Council, and the International Court of Justice to simulate. MUN takes a week at the United Nations and compresses it into a weekend for an MUN conference. These conferences, which are annual and are held locally, will have you write a paper on a position you are given. You will then submit the paper before attending at the conference's set location with the rest of your school team. The expected attire is Western Business Formal. MUN started in 1945, coming from the Model League of Nations. Originally only for college and university, MUN is now for middle and high school, with conferences being held around the world. But this won't help. This will help. This shows all those hundreds of conferences being held for hundreds and occasionally thousands of attendees. MUN is truly a global event that brings students from around the world together to discuss serious issues, and I find that really inspiring about MUN. Now, conference debate varies, but it will usually consist of opening, caucuses, a discussion among the whole group to debate details and write resolutions, attempting to vote on those resolutions, and then closing debate. A crisis committee is in a war or humanitarian emergency that will operate after opening in continuous caucus where delegates can write directives, which are little actions which they and any conspirator can submit to navigate debate. More on crisis committees later. I'm going to try and explain more about how MUN is significant to me and this world through some of my own experiences. I applied my last year of middle school. I got into my high school's MUN program in 2015. I was passionate about politics and history, and I joined my classmates twice a week to prep for conference. We practiced writing resolutions and position papers. We practiced debate procedure. But most importantly, we kept up with the world around us that we lived in through the news. Representing in Seattle, Vietnam on the Human Rights Council on my first conference was great. I worked with people I'd never met before to pass resolutions on cultural appropriation, and the rights of indigenous people. It was powerful to do that and know that some real diplomats couldn't achieve that. Flying to Washington, D.C. for Venezuela on an ad hoc security council was also great. Ad hocs deal with all conference topics. It's one of the most advanced committees a delegate can do. In addition, the Deputy Prime Minister of Malaysia spoke there, showing me that these leaders know MUN is important. Representing Iran on Bashar al-Assad's side during the Syrian civil war on a joint crisis committee was different. I was on the joint crisis committee for the pro-Assad bloc. Russia's interventions were very recent at the time. It was very new to me and very controversial. But part of MUN is representing positions that you may not personally agree with, but in doing so, you can find yourself more empathetic to people on the other side of your personal opinion and deal with more controversial issues like Syria's civil war from a more open-minded perspective. No technology while delegates are debating. So that's why, as a page at my high school's hosted Skyman Conference, I relayed messages. Doing this gave me respect for the other students that put in the hard work volunteering to put on these conferences for other delegates to attend to. My first MUN year ended. I had grown in my debate and my diplomacy skills. I re-entered the interview application process. I was with a different team, but I was an MUNer ready for the next cycle of conferences. Representing China, pro-Russia on the Russia-Ukraine crisis, and the war in the Central African Republic with more impassioned, more tough debate delegates to debate with and against was a great opening to a new year. My second crisis committee was representing Spanish Republicans in Vancouver, Canada. historical crisis committee operates on a specific historical event. We came up with a different outcome than what really happened. We won. Awards are given at the end of the conference, and they're split into three categories. A delegate award for delegates that best represented debate, cooperation, and conduct. A literary award for position papers, and team awards for best small and large delegation teams coming to the conference. You think this is too much for a teenager. This is dark. This is serious. There are laughs. There's camaraderie. There's a social. It's not all dark, gritty politics. We know it's a simulation. Some of these positions aren't our own, but it's a simulation. MUN has allowed me to connect with people with my passion to grow and learn. And I think that's what MUN is most importantly about, connecting people and educating them about the international community we live in. Thank you.
Great job, Mike.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Ignite Seattle 32 took place on February 23rd at Town Hall Seattle. The MC was Scott Birken. Ignite Seattle 33 is coming up on May 18th, again at Town Hall Seattle. Thank you to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.